Thanks very much, Michael. Next up is Professor Alex Molnar of Arizona State University. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for that warm introduction, Professor Shevlin. And I'd also like to say it's an honor to be here. You know, I've been working at this being commercialism in schools, for over 20 years now. And I can tell you that my first experience of it as a younger academic 20 years ago was at a conference for curriculum specialists. And I was wandering around in the vendors hall, and I'm accustomed to seeing textbook publishers and people providing audiovisual aids and so on. And I walked past one booth, and it was McDonald's. And I went back, and I thought, well, this is what possibly could McDonald's be doing here? And they had a full panoply of curriculum materials on things such as nutrition, the environment. And I said to myself, as I collected these materials, now, I'm teaching a course for school principals and teachers called curriculum planning. And never in my wildest imaginings did I think that one of the first sources that I would seek out for information about the best available knowledge on nutrition and on environmental protection, it would be McDonald's Corporation. So I looked with interest at these materials and found rather quickly that essentially what they contained was propaganda of the most crude sort, which explained, justified, and rationalized what were then McDonald's common practices with regard to the food that they served and with regard to the amount of waste that they were creating. Because at that time, it was vastly worse than it is now. I mean, the U.S. countryside was literally littered with McDonald's hamburger wrappers, cartons, plastics, and so on. So I said to myself, this is odd and it's perverse. I'm teaching a course in curriculum planning, and there's nothing whatever here about these sorts of materials. So I went back and I said to my students, I said, can you bring in examples of this? Maybe this is unusual. Maybe this is really just something, it's an anomaly, it's odd, it shouldn't be happening. And within a week or two, I had in my class at the university two large boxes filled with materials that had been placed in schools by corporations, every one of which sought to tell, in one way or another, the corporate story. Now, I want to get into commercialism in schools and the issues that we're engaged with when we speak of commercialism in schools. But before doing that, I think it's necessary to provide a somewhat broader context within which we can locate these activities in order to understand what's really going on here. And in order to do that, I think it's probably important to take a look at the interplay in contemporary society between the language of democracy and liberty and the language of the market. You know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, we're told in the United States and throughout the world, I believe, that democracy is on the march, that democracy rings triumphant, that democracy is the force of the future. But in developed country after developed country, where there are stable, long-term democratic governance structures, in one country after another, we see the public sector starved for funds. Teaching at universities in the United States, for example, at the University of Wisconsin, where I taught for many years, when I began teaching there in 1971, the state provided 65% of the cost of educating every student. 65%. And it made that commitment to the education of every student. Now the public commitment of resources for education in Wisconsin is down around 20%. The same is true in Arizona, where I am now. And that's been made up primarily by providing high-cost loans to students by which they can provide their own education, which places them in enormous levels of debt going forward. And having helped raise five children, I can tell you that this is a worrisome prospect for our family and many families. Now, if it's true that to some degree you can read the history of a culture or civilization in its architecture, then it's helpful perhaps to think about European and American architecture since the Middle Ages. Since the Middle Ages, you see, the architectural landscape in Europe in the Middle Ages was dominated by religious structures, cathedrals, churches, abbeys, and so on. In the United States, with the American Revolution, in the 18th century, the 19th century, the landscape, the architectural landscape in the United States was dominated by political buildings. The Capitol, the White House, these are familiar icons. The dominant architectural vernacular of the late 20th and early 21st century might well be said to be trade towers and shopping malls. And I think that's an indicator of the relative importance of the political democracy within which we live and the market forces with which we cope. And the extent to which what is unleashed upon us is something called a market, which we are given to believe exists outside of time and space and human control. It is a deity. Look into the face of a euro or a dollar bill and see God. The market is there. And the economists, the priests of the marketplace, tell us that any human intervention with this deity will anger it, and therefore it must be propitiated with sacrifices. And the sacrifices are made palatable through the most advanced forms of capitalist narrative, and those are contained in marketing and advertising. To a large extent, as an educator, to use an educational metaphor, marketing is the curriculum of our culture. And like any curriculum, it has messages and values. Now, what are those messages and values that are associated with marketing if you look at it as a curriculum? Well, for one thing, marketing wants to evoke desire. It wants you to desire things. And in order to encourage one to desire, one must be made to some degree dissatisfied and unhappy. To state it baldly, you stink. You stink. And you really need mouthwash. To state it plainly, you're unpopular because you don't have the proper shampoo. And if you look at certain commercials, people are they have orgasms in the shower while shampooing. So you are deficient, but you can be made sufficient if you drive the right car, buy the proper jeans, drink the good cola, shower with the proper shower gel, and so on. We can make you whole. We can make you attractive. We can make you sexy. We can put a tiger in your tank. The Celtic tigers should relate to this, right? Put a tiger in your tank. You will be jet propelled. We can make you happy, and happiness resides in the consumption of things. So you're unhappy, and you should be unhappy because you stink. But we can make you smell good. All you got to do is buy something. You'll be fast, powerful, and sweet smelling. And not only that, you'll be irresistible in almost every way imaginable. Holy smokes, I don't know, what are we sitting in here for? We should be out at the mall. It's Christmas time out there already. I don't know if you noticed. Comes earlier in Ireland than it does even in the United States, I must say. You've got the jump on us. So, now there's a certain problem here with regard to consumption, and that is the modern economy has not been very good at equalizing the distribution of wealth and privilege. And therefore, so how do you get the masses of people to consume without the funds to do so? Well, it's very simple. You allow them to use money that they don't have. You offer them credit. So you can have credit to buy things that you don't need, so you can spend money that you don't have to provide a profit to people that you don't know. It's a wonderful system. And if you think about it, it really is a marvelous mechanism of social control. It is so much better than jackbooted thugs, brown shirts, I guess in Ireland it'd be blue shirts, eh? Appearing at the door, doing what they do, their little tap dance on your skull with truncheons and things like that. Don't need it. Ronald McDonald is ever so much more efficient. And all he wants you to do is to have a happy meal. That's all he wants you to do. So if you've ever wondered what would the contemporary manifestation of Marx's term wage slave look like, behold, an overweight American wielding two or three credit cards, charged up to the max, with a leveraged mortgage on their house that they can't afford, with payments on a large screen TV that they don't have the time to watch, and trying to hold down three jobs to pay for it all, and we wonder what's happened to civic engagement, and we wonder why our culture has become coarsened. Credit is a very, very important part of the whole mechanism of consumer society. People must be made to feel comfortable with debt, and they must be made to incur a lot of debt. It is the drug that keeps commercial culture in contemporary society moving forward. Now, in the United States, we've taken this to extraordinary extremes. We now have a government that is financing an illegal war, a destructive war in Iraq with Chinese money. The entire country has given itself over to an orgy of debt for things that we don't need, most of us don't want, and that provide nothing of value, nothing of value to the greater society. If you go back in the history of American commercialism, there's one name that you keep tripping over, and the name is Edward Bernays. Now, Edward Bernays is an interesting fellow. He invented, arguably, the modern public relations industry. He was a nephew of Sigmund Freud's on both sides. No mean feat. So clearly, this is a person to reckon with. Now, he cut his teeth selling the First World War to the Americans in the Wilson administration's Committee on Public Information. When he came back, he was demobilized and had to figure out what to do with himself, so he invented public relations in the United States. He was an articulate, well-spoken person who was greatly interested in social science and the uses of social science, and he was unapologetic about the role of propaganda in modern mass democracies as a mechanism for addressing the question, the age-old question, how do you control the crowd? How do you control the crowd without recourse to violence and force? This was a man who in the 1920s in the United States, when women were liberating themselves and advocating for a greater and more equal participation in American society, he was a man who united that female desire for greater participation and emancipation with the need of the tobacco industry to sell more cigarettes. Because tobacco cigarette sales were flat in the United States at that time, but there was a large untapped resource for the cigarette industry, and it was women. But it wasn't socially acceptable for women to be seen smoking. So the tobacco industry clearly had a problem. Edward Bernays arranged for wealthy socialites to march in the Easter parade in New York, openly smoking and labeling their cigarettes, this is brilliant, torches of liberty. Torches of liberty. And thereby, he established what he referred to as rhetorical hegemony. In other words, how do you argue against it? A torch illuminates. Who could be anti-torch? It's a good thing. It sheds light. I mean, if you look at the the sort of inscriptions, the insignia of university, you're going to not have to look very far to see a torch. It's a good thing. And liberty. Who could be against it? Who could be against it? It's the very thing that George Bush sees when he looks into Vladimir Putin's eyes. It's liberty. It's liberty. So then, you take this idea of marketing as social control, and you meld it with consumerist societies, and you produce something roughly equivalent to what we have now. Excuse me. You evoke dissatisfaction. You promise to make people happy through consumption, and you give them what they don't need but are encouraged to think they want quickly through credit. And you've sewn up the whole basket. Excuse me. You have manipulated emotion. You have distorted rational thought. And you have controlled behavior. And all the while, telling people that they are free. Because after all, there are 16 different berry-scented shampoos that they can purchase. And that choice, that commercial choice, that consumer choice is represented as the fundamental choice within the context of modern consumerist society. It is a trivial choice. It is a choice framed by others, unknown to you and unknowable by you, about things that don't matter to you in a fundamental way. But it is framed as the most important manifestation of our liberty and freedom, our desire to walk down that shopping mall street just around the corner here and walk into any store and pick any one of 17 different sweaters, shampoos, cat foods, you name it. That is the good life. That is liberty. So we have a population in the United States, I'm sure it isn't true in Ireland, that will rebel at the thought of higher taxation. Taxes are bad because, after all, the public sector doesn't know how to spend money. Only the private sector knows how to spend money in that lean, mean, efficient way that welcomes us into their endless phone trees. There's cybernetic loops of information from which we can never escape. It's a very welcoming face. So we rebel. We've been asked to rebel at the idea of taxation because it turns out that taxation angers the god of the market. And the god of the market will withdraw the benefits of the market if there's too much taxation on the priestly class, and this being, of course, the corporations and the corporate executives who feed the market. On the other hand, this same population, and it's quite a remarkable, when you think about it, it's an amazing feat of consciousness to have done this. This same population will think nothing of spending literally thousands of dollars in interest payments on credit card debt. Money that doesn't go to their communities, money that may go halfway around the world, three quarters away around the world, to people they've never heard of or never known, for projects which have nothing to do with the well-being of their community, over which they have no oversight, no say, no control. They will happily and without objection enter into this servitude and pay this credit card debt, which is a form of destructive taxation on consumption. So on the one hand, public taxation, which is visible, accountable, and which is directed toward the community, is made to be bad. Private taxation in the form of interest payments on credit cards is said to be a matter of choice and good. It's very, very interesting. We have a population of people now who express their individuality, particularly among the young, by wearing the same clothes, drinking the same soft drinks, eating the same fast foods. It is a perfect example, in my mind anyway, of what the sociologist David Riesman in the United States in the 1950s referred to as the lonely crowd. And so we ask ourselves collectively, scratch our heads, wonder, look about, and say, well, why is there so much alienation in this culture? Why don't we feel as connected as we once did? Am I imagining this, or am I just getting old? But wasn't it true that people used to have more time for each other? Wasn't it true that multitasking wasn't something to be desired, but something to be fled from? Wasn't it true that we used to have an opportunity to sit with one another and argue and laugh and cry and debate, and that was, in essence, what we meant when we said a good life? And now we're dancing with a corpse, a very pretty corpse, but it's dead. It's lifeless. Objects can make, and you've seen it all, any parent has seen it, and we've certainly, probably each of us have our own examples, of somebody, some child, and perhaps some adult as well, who wants something, some object, only to achieve it, to charge it, to buy it, to do whatever, and then be disappointed in it and walk away from it after a short while. And this happens over and over again. This is an example of that cycle of dissatisfaction, satisfaction, repeat. Dissatisfaction, satisfaction, repeat. And it is the cold comfort that objects provide, when in fact, our most profound longings as human beings seem to be for genuine, honest, direct communion with other human beings. We can provide for ourselves what we need if we don't have a bushel basket of objects standing between us. Well, against this background, then, isn't it obvious why corporations would want to be in the schools? I mean, of course, schools should be colonies of corporations. Because if they're not colonized by corporations, then they're a threat to the priestly order. So they must be colonized. The young must be made unable to imagine a world with different values than consumerist values. It's terribly important that corporations be in the schools. They mean to inculcate consumerist values. They mean to do that. They mean to tell their corporation's story. After the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Alaska, in Prince William Sound, it wasn't months before Exxon was distributing to every secondary school in the United States a film called Scientists and the Oil Spill, or some such. But in essence, what this film conveyed was an unreal world in which you would almost think, if you weren't aware of the background and the devastation of that oil spill, you would almost think that Prince William Sound was actually better now than it was before. Somehow, these millions of gallons of oil had improved it. I mean, it was a kind of magical process. So any corporation that has a problem that it wants to solve is going to attempt to put its story before students in schools. And of course, corporations want to make money. They want to make money. As kids in the United States, and I'm quite confident it's likely to be true in Ireland as well, not only have an enormous amount of money at their own disposal, you know, those little 50-cent pieces add up, those 1 euro coins, they add up, you know, they add up. There are a lot of children there who spend their money. But even perhaps more importantly, and a lot of you may have scratched your heads, why does this corporation that doesn't market directly to a child want to do something in a school? I mean, why does Peugeot want to be in primary schools? I mean, kids can't drive Peugeots. They can't drive a car. Well, you know, according to some market research in the United States, children influence 80% of the brand choices in their families. 80%. And marketers self-consciously attempt to create what they call the nag factor. They wish to intervene between the child and their family, and they wish to use the school as the crowbar that pries open the door. Not the only one, but an important one. Because that particular crowbar comes with a legitimacy that advertising on the side of a bus, that putting an ad on the television or the radio or whatever the venue may be, doesn't have. Because, of course, what goes on in schools is supposed to be good for you. So surely, surely, the schools wouldn't send anything home. They wouldn't allow anything in. That's in someone else's interests. It would be in the interests of the child. So commonsensically, parents and children believe this must be good for me. And so you can almost see a quasi-religious mantra developing here, can't you? By serving Tesco, I serve the children. By serving Peugeot, I serve the children. I was raised Catholic. A couple of you were probably raised Catholic as well. And so you're accustomed to this responsive liturgy. Okay? So maybe you could say, I serve Cadbury, therefore I serve the young. It is through Cadbury that I serve the young. It is through McDonald's that I bring the benefits of exercise and health to the young. Oh, McDonald's loves exercise, as does Cadbury. I mean, I read one account of one of their programs in which they were promoting the ability to get, this one really stood out for me, volleyball stanchions, you know, to hold up the nets for the volleyball team. And one fellow calculated it would take 900 Cadbury candy bars per volleyball team member to get those stanchions. 900. Do the math. That's a lot of chocolate. Do you know how long you'd have to play volleyball to work off 900 chocolate bars? Well, same way with McDonald's. I mean, the clock is running, right? I mean, you're getting fatter while you're walking. Yeah, they do it all for you. They do it all to you would be the more honest marketing slogan. But marketing isn't about honesty. Marketing is about serving a special interest. And we really, at some point, have to come to terms with the fact that corporations aren't human beings. They're not nice. And they're not evil. They are soulless creations of human beings. Now, in the United States, we have this perverse Supreme Court ruling in the 19th century that declared that under the United States Constitution, corporations were persons. They were legally persons. Strange persons. They can create their own parents in the form of holding companies. They have godlike abilities, but they also therefore have certain constitutional rights, the rights, free speech, and so on. And so you see it all the time where people take it personal. If you say something about a corporation, it's personal. Oh, well, come on now. You know, these are not even, I mean, these are moms and dads that work in these corporations, you know. I mean, what are we talking about? Well, the people working in the corporations could be wonderful folks. But the corporation itself doesn't exist for the common weal of Ireland, the United States, Germany, France, or any other country. It exists to provide a profit to the people that own it, whether they live in Thailand, China, South Africa, or anywhere else. That's it. And by law, if it's a publicly traded corporation in the United States, they must do that. Or their directors can be brought up on charges. So when people say, oh, well, you know, we're all in it together. No, we're not all in it together. We're not all in it together.